Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Happy April Fool's Day, plus one. The ghosts of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, the Roosevelt cousins, Theodore and Franklin, even some of America's lesser noted presidents, would be appalled at the rapid disintegration of American democracy that Donald Trump is intent upon in his bid as King Emperor of the USA, goaded most likely in addition to his fantastical fascism by the fact he goes to jail at the end of his presidency. Would that it were possible he could be forced to face his presidential predecessors in a court of democracy's justice and not only be impeached, but be forced to immediately go to jail to serve out his conviction for treason, which, despite the legal aziz, he has been found guilty of in a court of law. Trump's determination to abolish the Constitution, especially the Bill of Rights, and ultimately decimate democracy, demonstrates a contemptible conceit of Napoleonic scale. The USA has suffered a few past bad presidents, even one or two who might also have attempted to parlay the presidency into autocratic oligarchy, but none so blatant as Bonespurs Trump. Impeachment for Donald Trump is the least punishment he should have for his attempt to abolish birthright citizenship. And now, something I wrote for my now defunct newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, which I think is still pertinent. One world for all, with the quote by the great historian A.J. P. Taylor, history is just one damned thing after another. Humanity's sly calculation of time might not fit any other world than its own, and even so is a compromise between observation and superstition. One of the larger misperceptions of our era is that early civilizations and the people who lived in them are archaic and beyond any relevance. We consider them the old, decayed, even decadent times, vanished into the fog of history and myth. But those were not the old times. They were actually the young times. This is the old time. Earth is getting older. Our species is aging. Our civilization approaches Alzheimer's. Our ancient ancestors were not the wintry gray heads we regard them as. We are the gray heads. They are instead the vigorous youth of Homo sapiens sapiens, ecstatic, reckless children, wildly avaricious and ruthlessly violent. We ought to think of them without condescension as the youthful nursery of our species. We too often scorn our ancestors as naive and aboriginal, and we condescendingly regard their epochs as simpler periods compared to our own generation's modernity, actually postmodernity, and sophistication. We forget what they learned for us, nearly everything we know. We are what they bequeathed us, an inseparable thread of maturation as well as deterioration. We are the old ones, born much later in Earth's age than our predecessors, whose brilliant and inspired youth constructed our own golden middle age. For all our technological skill, we are enervating beings absorbed only in our own comfort, a species lazy middle-aged dream of an effortless materialistic paradise, a sign of incipient old age. We are at the cusp of a new millennium, only a quarter of a century into it, that already moves as rapidly into its realm of time with the acceleration of a starship. A millennium is an awesome thought when you think about it, and we look into this new one in fearful anticipation, numb from too much change too quickly. We are essentially afraid of the future, not only because our corpses lie somewhere up the timeline, but our dreams of the future are seriously handicapped by a possibility of endless war against phantoms who have very different dreams and are able to strike anywhere at any time to express them. But we are also worried by a grim perception that we have seriously injured our home planet and that most of the familiar guideposts are continually ripped away, leaving us perplexed about what is next. Perhaps a millennium up the line, the 20th century that has just passed, might only be remembered as the advent of the nuclear age, when the future really began, or for its human representations of darkness and light, personified by Hitler and Gandhi. Perhaps also for Einstein, who changed everything. A millennium evokes old prophecies, apocalyptic cults that believe the end is close at hand and flourish to make it likely. The world was scheduled to end at the first millennium of the Christian age with an identical script, as well as scripture, of Armageddon, with the exception we have developed the means to accomplish the abominations ancient prophecy continues to incite. Our collective angst is world suicide, brought on by the conflict of our parallel tendencies of piety and murder. Our past grips the present grimly, wickedly. We feel out of phase. We sense we have lost control, or are out of control, as we lunge into this new century millennium with accelerating velocity. We instinctively resist change, even as we promulgate it. Change percolates chaos. Our fear is that we are being forcibly propelled into an unknown future in which we will only recognize ourselves opaquely, moving through an indistinct environment, a future worldwide civilization of colossal promise and terror is projected. Gene splitting, recombinant DNA, invented and patented life forms. These human tamperings with the secrets of life frighten the majority of us more than the continuing possibility of obliteration. We live at present in an age of intellectual reversion, of savage descent into public ignorance and intolerance, which are generally present, but not often given the forum or respect of recent years. We pay serious, nearly morbid attention to the pathological pieties and simplifications of religious zealots who act at the extreme edge of our anxieties and reduce the national dialogue to a medieval level reminiscent of witch burnings. Although we are inclined to measure progress through technical achievement, it should be as important to concentrate on the contradictory evolution of political liberty and the slow development of a world civilization. Karl Marx anticipated such a civilization in the 19th century, and the two world wars of the 20th century made it impossible to resist. Nuclear power, the fortress of nationalism, has rendered it obsolete. The contradiction lies with the rights and liberties of individuals and minorities, and with former colonies and subject nations that have been released from foreign dominance and reassert their claims as separate and independent peoples while genociding themselves with ancient feuds and virulent ethnic cleansing. Another contradiction is that a very few powerful persons and corporations wish to rule the world in much the manner earlier dictators, fascists, and communists dreamed of doing. International class war is replacing nationalism, and its first real aspect has been the war on terrorism conducted by the Christian West against the Islamic East. The designer New World Order, quote unquote, is a direct schism between the rich and the poor. The two-party system in the United States reflects this class war. Two political parties do not represent the people of the country any more than Congress, the White House, or Wall Street. Talk of forming third and fourth parties are predicated on the assumption that a two-party system actually exists. Instead, it is one big party with two heads. The true second party is made up of the disenfranchised who seldom take part in the political process and generally do not vote because they don't believe it has any effect. The only real political parties in the USA are the Rich Party and the Poor Party. The raw excesses of corporate capitalism in its quest to dominate world trade and commerce since the end of the Cold War, represented by the empirical rise of the USA, are under siege, however, by a mounting turbulence caused by intense pressure from below, the bottom of the resource trickle-down, which is uniting the majority of overcrowded humanity that struggles for a decent living on the planet. This upheaval collates every previous civil rights and working class struggle and might very well readjust the center of power and pioneer the first true, universally human community in its long evolution. The major barrier to that universal community is the United States, which consistently declares itself the only form of government capable of uniting the world's peoples into an umbrella democracy of its own form. Paradoxically, at the very moment that democracy is in serious decline in the homeland, the United States has evolved to world supremacy in two centuries since its revolution, which has been the ambition all along, despite fearful and protective tendencies toward isolation. A history of the USA is not entirely an evolution of democracy, but more essentially, its rise as a superpower. The two world wars of the 20th century made the USA a superpower, during which it built a war machine unsurpassed in history, while demonstrating a productive capacity that overwhelmed allies and enemies alike. This nation was created by war, maintained its union by war, became a continental power by decimating native peoples and invading its southern neighbor and stripping it of its northern half, and became a world power by terminating the decrepit colonial empire of another. The United States is among history's most successful militant societies and now dominates global politics with its immense and highly sophisticated potential for total war as the only reigning superpower after emerging the victor of a half-century Cold War against Communist Russia, which was characterized by inconclusive brushfire wars and a horrendous nuclear arms race that economically and politically broke its competitor, but seriously injured its own economies and ideologies. the collapse of the Soviet Union and subsequent disappearance of communism from major regions of the world has significantly reduced the options and bargaining power of so-called third world nations. The end of the Cold War and Soviet communism gave the industrial northwestern part of the world tremendous power to reshape the politics and economies of the southern and eastern areas. A major consequence has been that the USA, the world's remaining superpower, has been able to act aggressively with impunity in these parts of the world without the threat of Soviet counteraction, as prevailed for nearly half a century. The new realities of world commerce have adversely affected American labor. Real work has been transferred overseas as corporate domination moves like a cancer through American culture. The country is governed by a council of merchants, similar to medieval Venice, with the exception of a comic charade of outer layer political marionettes. Cheaper labor and manufacturing costs in third world nations not only add to an imbalance of trade, but considerably shrink the jobs of American workers as the U.S. shifts from a producer nation to a global headquarters complex in which computer programmers, accounts clerks, and stockbrokers are more important to the economy than steel workers or farmers. The foundations of the modern independent world economy were laid in the late 19th century with business cartels dominating the international trade in raw materials through colonizing most of the third world and infusing billions of dollars into foreign capital investment, primarily in Eastern Europe, by Western Europe, North America, and European colonies. The two new great industrial powers in 1900 were Germany and the United States. The USA started the 20th century by inheriting, as a result of a brief triumphant war, the remaining vestiges of moribund Spain's deteriorated empire of a half a millennium, and became overnight a world power, except that its new empire was situated on islands rather than mainlands. The real power the United States developed over the century was through neocolonialism, dominance by proxy control of foreign economies, industries, politicians, and generals, with coercion matched by corruption instead of occupation and colonial ministries. The burden of destroying Nazi Germany fell primarily upon capitalist America and communist Russia. Essentially, the U.S. provided the material and Russia the man and woman power. After the war, these Novu superpowers polarized the world into nuclear-armed camps separated by an infamous Iron Curtain, which symbolized their fierce competition for supremacy. 1 year short of its platinum anniversary, Bolshevik communism disintegrated into ruin and chaos. Once hoped to be the essential revolution of the masses against the long history of repression, Bolshevism quickly developed into a monstrously cruel and eventually stagnant system that simply fell apart from the mendacious inertia of its own history. The vast empire of Russian republics, and that's a quote, and East European satellites collapsed into bitter splinters of ancient hatreds as around the world communism was simultaneously rejected as a successor to colonialism and as the structure and ideology of newly enfranchised governments. Instead of seizing the future and proclaiming a new man, quote unquote, through world revolution, communism swiftly diminished as a relic of the past into the dustbin of history. That's also a quote. The God that both failed and died, which has left the United States as the world's only superpower at this first quarter of the 21st century. the deceit that capitalism and democracy are intertwined quickly came apart following communism's collapse. The result is that the USA has failed to show itself to the world as a true democracy, corrupting its real manifest destiny with the decrepit quest for empire, much to the disgust and discouragement of the rest of the world. This is Michael McCusker. I have been thinking lately of friends who have died since returning stateside USA following our mutual survival of the Vietnam War travesty. We were all USMC, Uncle Sam's misguided children, quote unquote, whose cynical war cry of semper fallacious amidst carnage and calamity helped retain whatever sanity and sense of humor that propelled us through carnage and post-war perplexity. Only Nick Overrocker, Pat Collins, the now dying Julius Maxwell Belcher, perhaps Albert Mitchell, who disappeared from contact after marrying his childhood sweetheart damn near the moment he got back to the USA and has never been heard from any of the rest of his since, remain not so firmly on terra firma. Frank Hassel, Apache Indian for Arizona or New Mexico, I forget which, essentially drank himself to death soon after his return to the USA, which he never acknowledged as his country, despite his enlistment in the USMC. The famous Ira Hayes, a Pima Indian who was famously photographed with other Marines raising the Stars and Stripes atop Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima in 1945, exited life in the same manner. And Max Belcher, a magnificent human raised in Liberia, Africa, both races, black and albino, conjuncted like a great stew, is probably the superior human being of us all, and he is now dying. Only the Hoosier, Pat Collins, and I survive of our very tight group of Vietnam Marine Corps correspondents and photographers.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.